Paul, and we're beginning another edition of Touchstones, which is a program that is devoted to the various religions of human beings, of humankind, and of various religions of all sorts. Most of my shows on this also is, by the way, my a celebration of sorts. This is actually, we've been on the air now for one whole year. About 50 shows that we've done more or less consecutively. And we have emphasized a great deal of Christianity, a great deal of New Age religions. And I thought that it was time to devote a little time to the to some of the great religious classics that we have and that exist, and that, you know, everyone needs to know about some of these from the various religions. And so we're starting a series that it may not be consecutive, because we will pause for various guests as they become available, on one of the great religious classics of all time, and a religious classic that anyone, any educated person should know and should read. It is definitely a book that is well-beloved and a deep part of American consciousness. The Transcendentalists, Emerson and Thoreau, were thoroughly imbued with the ideas of this wonderful Hindu epic, translated later by a Victorian Sir Edwin Arnold as the Song Celestial, also known as the, and best known as in the English, as the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita is our topic today. I'm going to emphasize on this show some of the basic ideas in the Gita, and less on the poetry of it. It's a relatively short book. It's only 18 chapters, and the chapters are pretty concise and didactic in a way. It is set up in a very dramatic structure, and it is considered part of the great Mahabharata. The Mahabharata is a sort of national epic, loosely compared with Homer's Iliad and Odyssey for the Greeks. The Mahabharata probably took a longer time to gestate. And it's a story about two families that are interrelated, and ultimately a war, a rivalry they have, and a great war they have for the dominance. And it sort of becomes a war of good over evil. And at that end, but they're also related to each other, and this is the part that I would emphasize, is that these folk here were related to each other, and needed to come to some reconciliation, and yet, you know, it was sort of like they were going to spoil for a fight, and there was no way to get around it. In this possibility, things. The Bhagavad Gita, by the way, is argued about when it was actually written. The early version is that it was written about 500 before the Common Era, and or 100 in the Common Era. My view is that it was written closer to around 200 in the Common Era. And there's a various ways that this is created. It depends on basically the historical ways of the commentaries. But I argue that it was probably slightly later than earlier, and probably took a number of years to things. It was probably also started out as a independent philosophical poem that was recast with the story, sort of the way that the Job story was recast, with the emphasis with a tag in at the beginning and the end of the heaven sequences in Job. With the Gita, we have the war between two branches of the Kusarava family, the Kauravas proper, that is, the 100 sons of Dhritarashtra, led by the eldest brother, Duryodhana, on the one hand, and on the other hand, their cousins, the Pandavas, the sons of Pandu, led by their eldest brother, Yudhishthira. Yudhishthira had been cheated out of his kingdom in a game of dice to which he had been challenged. He lost and was thereby condemned to cede his share of the kingdom to Duryodhana, while he and his four brothers had to go into exile for 13 years, the last of which they had to spend in concealment. All this they did, but when Yudhishthira asked for his kingdom back, Duryodhana bluntly refused, and Yudhishthira, who was by nature a pacifist, had an instructive loathing for war, as any good king would have, reduced his demands to a mere 5 villages, and still Duryodhana refused. As a final gesture, Yudhishthira sent his friend Krishna, son of the Vasudeva, and head of a neighboring clan, on the embassy in which Krishna was made the final bid for peace. Krishna was, however, not merely a local prince of no great importance. He was also God incarnate, the great god Vishnu, who had taken on human flesh and blood, the great avatar for the protection of the good and for the destruction of evildoers and for setting up the law of righteousness. This Duryodhana and everyone else knew. But even so, when it came to choosing between Krishna's person and his army, Duryodhana chose the army, while Arjuna, Yudhishthira's youngest brother and Krishna's bosom friend, chose Krishna alone. Duryodhana then, knowing full well that Krishna was God, rejected for the last time Yudhishthira's offer, thereby defying a god and God's self. Yudhishthira, having gone to the utmost limit to avoid war, now reluctantly gives in, and the scene is now set for battle that was to prove ferociously destructive. There is, however, a last-minute hitch. Arjuna's nerve fails. And this is where we are at the eve of this great war, a war of epic proportions, a war of horrible destruction. Nothing like it exists except in modern warfare. Arjuna had been part of a war party, and Krishna, who had volunteered to act as his charioteer, is dumbfounded at his sudden about-face. Of all people, Arjuna, his boon companion and comrade in arms, the hero who had wrestled with the great god Shiva as Jacob had wrestled with the angel of the Lord, the bravest of the brave and the soul of generosity, Arjuna flatly refused to fight. This is the starting point of the Gita, the Lord's song, and the ostensible purpose of the Gita is to persuade Arjuna to fight. True, though the poem has never wholly lost sight of, but the bulk of the poem is not concerned with respective merits of war and peace or with the deepest things of humans and God. No wonder, then, that some German scholars have sought to dig out an original Gita from under what they consider to be a mass of strictly irrelevant metaphysics. No wonder that others have tried to treat the Gita as a separate poem and somehow got over it, looking for some kind of Ur-Gita. Rudolf Otto, of important early 20th century comparative religious strain, was definitely of this opinion. There is plenty of didactic matter in the Mahabharata, which, by the way, is encyclopedic. I mean, it's a huge and vast work of many, many volumes, and it has been translated, but only the most diligent of readers would actually seek out that translation. Almost the whole of the books 12 and 13, much of the books of 3 and 5, but none of these is Krishna the teacher. Only the book 14 does he condescend to teach Arjuna again, in the so-called Anugita, the Gita recapitulated, which in fact is no recapitulation at all, but for it omits all of the teachings of the Gita, which, because it was new, was described by Krishna as being most mysterious. And these new aspects of the Gita, and one of the reasons why I tend to date it later than earlier, is the revelation of the love of God, the great bhakti orientation of things, which I think actually may have been a Hindu response, a native Hindu response, in terms of learned religious discourse, to the message of Jesus. This is no accident, for Arjuna had proven himself unworthy of receiving the divine mystery. In the heat of battle, he had forgotten every word Krishna had said. In the Anugita, he is merely treated to a rehash of what his far more religious-minded brother had been told by the dying grandsire, Bhisma, at enormous and wearisome length, through mammoth books of 12 and 13, by far the longest of the epic in the world. Yes, and that is, Mahabharata is probably the longest epic poem in the world, and took generations to to write, and probably it'd take a generation to read. Hence, the Gita was originally conceived was not an original part of the Gita. It was spoken by the Lord incarnate, and this is important, as this most solemn moment of the whole enormous story, moment which everything else has been working. Arjuna refuses to obey the divine command, and for the best of reasons, he will not fight a fratricide of war, simply for the love of power. He will not slay his own kith and kin, among whom are many of his benefactors. Krishna is not content merely to use arguments already familiar to him, his caste duty as a warrior, for instance. He seeks rather to reveal to him the structure of the universe as it really is, and in which Arjuna is merely a pawn moved by the hand of an all-powerful God, whose will no man or woman or God can resist or thwart. And so that is the story background of the Bhagavad Gita in brief. And what I want to emphasize today is some of the philosophical aspects of the work and its principal teachings. Now, the Bhagavad Gita is written within the context of a very sophisticated religious culture. And a lot of it can be seen as an epitome, as a recapitulation of the general conclusions or meanings of what that religious culture is. This, is, of course, is the religious culture of India, of the Vedas, of the Brahman, of the Upanishads. Most of the religious texts of India are of no firm date, and the Upanishads, with the possible exception of the Maitri, which is a post-Buddhistic, one would probably not be going far wrong as dated sometime between the 5th and 2nd centuries before the Common Era. The contents of the Gita shows influences of the Upanishads and of early Buddhism were familiar, as is also the philosophy called Samkhya, which is later used to be the basis for an understanding of yoga. The native commentators on the Gita, one of the earliest is Ramanuja, who was probably who had a theory of which is usually called qualified non-dualism. In his commentary in the Gita, as elsewhere, he is concerned with establishing the absolute supremacy of the personal God, Krishna, not only over phenomenal world, but also over the impersonal absolute Brahman. In this sense, he reacts against the absolute monism of Shankara, for whom a reality Brahman was unfractionably one, all diversity and multiplicity being ultimately an illusory appearance. This world of illusionary appearance, which is Maya or Prakriti, includes everything that is in any way conditioned by time, space, or causation. Its characteristic feature is action, karma, which is the principle of change. You must then follow that God himself is, so far as he is, an agent and involved in the affairs of the real. Real is Brahman only, and Brahman is one. Thus, according to Sankara, it is not just a metaphysical statement, but a fact, or rather the fact of mystical experience. When the mystic says, I am Brahman, he is speaking a literal and only truth. This is, of course, from the point of view of absolute reality. According to Ramanuja, the universe can be divided into two segments, which he follows in Samskaya, matter and spirit, Purusha and Prakriti. Matter or material nature is dynamic, as it is in Marx, and it includes everything that is subject to change, and this comprises not only what we normally understand matter to be, but also the senses, the mind, the ego, and also what we would call the soul. Further on, we have the emphasis on Purusha, which is pure spirit, and in the non-dualist Vedanta, just the world soul or the self that is identical to all contingent beings. It is a plurality of spiritual monads or selves which attach themselves and are bound to the process of progress, transmigration. They bind themselves to Prakriti and thereby don't know their own essence. And this then is one of the emphases in Indian thing is to learn how to separate the spiritual from the material in a kind of ultimate dualism. In the words of the Upanishad, Svetshvantara, it is imperishable, infinite city of Brahman. Two things there are, wisdom and unwisdom, hidden, established there. Perishable is unwisdom, and wisdom is immortal. Whoever knows wisdom and unwisdom rules, he is another. According to Ramanuja, the principal theme of the Gita, and in this I think he is absolutely right. Now we should consider some of the main concepts of the Gita in a little detail, time allowing. The first view or importance of the Gita is the nature of the individual self. I was listening to Houston Smith the other day, one of the grand old men of comparative religion. And as he says, in his summary of Indian religion generally, is that Indian religion is most astute psychologically. Both in its Hindu form and in its Buddhist form, which is sort of the Buddhism is the traveling form of Hinduism. It transmigrates into other cultures or has, and spread around the world in a variety of ways. Whereas Hinduism sort of stays in India. Except as Hindus move around the world, and then they may very well keep their religion, as they will also keep their caste identity as part of their family or tribal identity. But so Indian religion is psychologically oriented, whereas Confucian religion, the religion of the Far East, China, tends more to be the religion of society and of people getting along together. And then we could say something else about Christianity. But let's continue here with what the individual self is. The first topic that Krishna broaches in his dialogue with Arjuna is the nature of the embodied self, which is obviously, you know, who are you that's fighting? The first thing then that Krishna establishes is the immortality of the bodied self. This self is immortal in two senses, as a timeless monad or a minute part of God and God's self. It is never born nor dies, nor will it ever come to be again, unborn, eternal, everlasting as it is primeval. Since it has been outside of time, to speak of it as birth or death is meaningless, and yet so far as it does in fact become linked with an individual psychosomatic organism, it is constantly reborn and constantly redies. In itself, it is static, timeless, eternal. In its transmigrations from body to body, it is indissoluble, connected with the given human personality. Salvation then consists in the final dissolution of the eternal matter from the ultimate material personality to which it is bound. It is the unlinking of the link with suffering and pain. Buddhists, however, were so careful to find what the self was that they often maintained that they denied the existence of a self altogether. The Gita certainly does not do this. On the contrary, the self in itself is a minute part of God. Yet while involved in a transmigratory process, it is so closely identified with a given personality that it can be fooled and doubt. The self can only be realized in its timeless immortality by intense concentration, yoga, by a process of the integration, and by complete detachment from the outside world. This state of complete detachment, in which the self returns to its natural state, where birth and death are a sheer impossibility, and which is the fixed, still state of Brahman, and in which one sees the self in itself, finds content therein. This state of still, static, timeless bliss is felt to be the utmost joy, because it is beyond time and presumably beyond death. The self is both static and passive. It cannot act, nor can it initiate action. Action is in the sphere of material nature and prakriti. Purusha doesn't act. Purusha is. Prakriti acts. Nature acts. And the self can only be said to act insofar as it's still conjoined to the psychosomatic organism. It is solely independent function of its experience. It is because it attaches itself to these psychosomatic elements that it comes to a birth. In the Gita, self-realization means felt experience of the self as a timeless monad and particle of God is the result of the absorption of all the powers of the human personality into the self. They are not destroyed, but fuse into a unity. This process is called yoga, in which contexts is usually translated as integration. When a man draws in on every side of his senses the proper object, as a tortoise might draw in its limbs, firm established in the wisdom of such a man, and again as the waters flow into the sea, fulfilled, whose ground remains unmoved, so too all desires flow into the heart of man, and as such a man wins peace, not the desirer of desires. Such a peace is achieved by the fusion of all the faculties of the human personality into the timeless self, culminating point in the process of integration. The self must not only be integrated, but purified of all sense of being a responsible ego. Though the whole human personality is now centered on it, it must recognize that in itself, it is merely a spectator at a play enacted by the body, mind, and soul. That with the body, mind, and soul and senses alone and isolated from the self, Do integrated human beings engage in action and renounce attachment for the cleansing of the self? The integrated human being renouncing the fruits of works gains an abiding peace, and a human being not integrated with these works is prompted by desire, being attached to its fruits, and is bound. So now we need to take a look at the nature of material nature, prakriti, or the bondage of the spirit. First, as we have seen in Samkhya system, matter and spirit are totally distinct and independent principles. In the Gita, this is not true. For God is the source of both. Spirits and selves are said to be minute parts of Him, and like Him have their essential being in eternity, not in time. Matter and material nature, prakriti, svabhava, is not more independent of Him than our individual selves. The action of nature is cyclic. That is, it rests on a so-called unmanifest, which it starts to move and diversity appears, the whole process being like to a day and a night in the creator god of Brahman. As the day dawning, all things manifest, spring forth from the unmanifest, and then at nightfall they dissolve again at the same time into the unmanifest. Yes, the whole host of beings comes ever anew to be. At fall, at night, it dissolves away, all helpless. At dawn of day, it rises up again. This is the Manvantara, which is the manifestation of the day, and the pralaya, or the disappearance at night of all manifest world. The whole universe is a sort of a cyclic breathing in and out of manifestation and withdrawal of manifestation. We breathe in and the world is, and we breathe out and we are no longer. We are not, nor is the world. When nature moves with the unmanifest into the manifest state of being, it differentiates itself into five cross elements of senses and their objects. The mind, the soul, here in the soul means buddhi, which is, as one would might recognize, represents the aspect that recognizes light, but light here is serenity, and ego, is reflected light. But in the Gita, nature is not independent. It belongs to Krishna, the personal God. Moreover, nature is defined above, which corresponds more or less exactly to Samkhya's categories, but only Krishna is the lower nature. There is a higher nature, a developed into life in which the world is kept in being. This would seem to refer to what Teller de Chardin calls the biosphere, the world of conscious beings, which are composites, as we have seen, of spirit and matter, individual human selves bound to the material world. This human spirit of matter is not fortuitous, but willed by God Himself. And obviously, the biosphere is more than just human beings, but all animals. Animals, again, representing the anima, representing breath, representing life, and so forth. To nature is the female principle, Krishna the male. The great Brahman nature is to me a womb, in it I plant the seed. From this derives the origin of all contingent beings. In whatever womb, whatever form arises and grows together, all those forms, great Brahman is the womb, and I the father, giver of the seed. And that's quoting the 14th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. The use of the words great Brahman is to mean material nature cannot detain us, but it is can be discussed later, inasmuch as it represents a transmutation of the classic dualism of Samkhya. The next aspect of this that I want to touch on briefly is the three constituents of nature, and these are in Sanskrit called sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva is being or being, or goodness, purity. Rajas is passion, energy, and darkness. And tamas is darkness, dullness, and sloth. So sattva is goodness and purity. It is stasis. And on one side of stasis is excessive passion and energy. And on the other side of stasis is dullness and sloth. So you can sort of see the right and left sides of the purity of detachment of sattva, of being nature. These constituents are quite basic to Samkhya system, but their nature and mode of manifestation is changed quite a bit in the Gita and elsewhere. We hear this, first hear of them on the Artha Veda. A lotus with nine gates developed by three strands, and it is a strange, a being strange, possessed of itself, that it is knower of Brahman, no. The idea again seems to be present in the Chandogya Upanishad, where all contingent being is apportioned between fire, water, and food, solid matter, which represent respectfully the colors red, white, and black. Everything in the phenomenal world is reducible to these three basic qualities. The red is corresponds to passion and energy, white to goodness and purity, and black to dullness and darkness. Another formal way that these three constituted elements, and they also classically relate to the three major up and down channels in your in later Tantra, of the Ida and the Pingala, and the Shishunma Shunshunu being here related to Sattva, is sort of how, in one way, karma works, or how action works and things. Again, to cite the Gita, by these three states of being, inhering in the constituents of this whole universe is led astray. God is the source of everything. God constitutes, however, the source of all activity. This point is made very clear. It is material nature's three aspects that do all works whatever. He whose self is by the ego fooled thinks it is I who do. But he who knows how the aspects and works are parceled out in categories, seeing things as they are, thinks that thus these aspects on aspects act, and thus thinking remains unattached. And yet so as the man in this world, so he is swayed by various aspects and bound to act only if the purpose of maintaining life. So action is off the balance beam, the pivot, or the axis of sattva being, which is in the classic sense of pure inactivity. But in this case, an inactivity that is not related to action at all. And that inertia is sort of anti-activity. And rajas is sort of pro-activity, but both of them are off-centered. Both of them represent sort of the stickiness of karma, I guess that might be one way to look at it, though it's not a use that the Gita puts it to. Human beings must be like God, not only in his eternal rest, but also in his selfless activity. God established human society and laid down the rules by which a human being can live, and he therefore expects human beings to cooperate. There is nothing that God need to do anywhere unattained that he need gain for work in which God moves. So, the emphasis on work and action then becomes a way of working with such emphasis that the action extinguishes itself into the sattvic realm. By contrast, action and inactivity, the performance of work and its renunciation, the renunciation of the fruit of action, is to create an unreal dilemma. For if you act without having any interest or care for the result of what you do, you have already renounced. And it is not the deed itself, but ultimately the selfish motive behind the deed that must be renounced. For instance, in the Isha Upanishad, succinctly puts it, abandon and then enjoy. Work should be done as if you were doing nothing at all. The man who sees worklessness and work itself and work in worklessness is wise among his fellows, integrated and performing every work. In other words, the active life, even of a warrior, is no bar against a sustained contemplation so long as all interest in the results has been suppressed. Stand fast in yoga, surrendering attachment. Karma, that's works in action, is constantly contrasted with jnana, knowledge and wisdom. The latter word meaning, like in the Greek gnosis and the Arabic marifa, not knowledge or normally understood by the intuitive apperception of ultimate reality beyond space and time. Wisdom is thus both the ultimate goal of works and at the same time abolishes the stickiness of works. When all a man's emprises are free from desire for fruit, and the motive of his works burn up in wisdom's fire, then wise men call him learned, and he works for sacrifice alone. For all the work he ever did entirely melts away. Work should be regarded as essentially a sacrifice. But unlike the routine sacrifice to the gods, which are designed to produce material benefits, this sacrifice is a true sacrifice of the human will, and the goal of it is to have done with once and for all the bondage of purposeful identity with work that entails. And so all works performed in sacrifice and wisdom find their consummation. Let's to sum up. Action is by its very nature binds, and therefore detach yourself from it. How do you detach yourself from it? Go on doing what is God's will for you to do, but accept failure as gladly as you would welcome success, indifferent always to the result. Works are only yours on loan. There is no sense to belong to you. Perform them then in a spirit of sacrifice. Now, sacrifice is a major component of archaic religion, and in this case, I would particularly draw Christians to thinking about the sacrifice of Jesus and the meaning of the cross and the things and what he does in that, holding still to that. And the Vedic sacrifices to God are designed to bring their own reward. Man sustains the gods so that they may sustain him in return. For instance, in the Mundaka Upanishad, this would lead to immortality, and practitioners of this sacrifice were self-wise, puffed up with learning, passing their days in the mists of ignorance. A very special sense, the sacrifice is Brahman. The offering is Brahman. Brahman, the sacrificial ghee offered by Brahman in the Brahman fire, who sinks himself into the sacrificial acts, which is Brahman. To Brahman must thereby go. Brahman then is the sacrifice, the oblation, the priest who offers up the oblation. But it is not the object of sacrifice. This is the personal God, Krishna alone, who is the recipient and Lord of all sacrifices. And this, by the way, is one of the great aspects of love. Sacrifice itself is said to derive from works, and works are said to have been seen through, performed as sacrifice. Only so can the bondage inherent in them be destroyed. The sacrifice approved by sacred ordinance and offered up by human beings who would not taste its fruits and who concentrate their minds is this alone. In sacrifice lies duty. Such sacrifice belongs to goodness, to the sattva. Once again, the message is detach yourself from all that you do, wherever sacred or profane, and it is prescribed by religion. And you can also see here that this is the way, this is the emphasis on the necessity of Arjuna's fighting his cousins, even though he doesn't want to. Then there is a rehash of the works that are appropriate to the four castes, and we can move beyond that. You can see the four castes, of course, as degrees of understanding of the world and how one identifies with the things that one does. Further, I will look at the aspect of the psychology of the Gita, the humans, the mind and its senses. Again, Samkhya is the background for this. Though the Gita, and this is important to know, when the Gita is used as an introductory text, some of its wonderful semantic moves, the way it makes a few changes in some of the classic formulations of Indian philosophy, are not easily to appreciate because you don't know the background of the formal philosophy. That it's tweaking, as it were, some interesting views of it. But for the mind and the senses, the human psyche consists of the soul, the mind and ego, and the five senses. All these are evolutes from material nature. They are not of the self. Interesting. Right? Yoga, inner creation, means bringing all these faculties of psyche under the control of the self. Curiously enough, the Gita has very little to say about the ego, except that it must be eliminated. It is a false center of personality insofar as it thinks it acts. It does nothing of the sort. As we have seen, for its constituents of nature are alone responsible for action under God's supervision. The emphasis that one is the doer is one of the paradoxes that arises in aspects of contemplative prayer, which I've talked about before, that your own sense of self as being doing anything, it doesn't mean that, you know, things stop or everything becomes, you know, a blank, you know, things move and continue to move, continue to breathe and think and have thoughts. But your sense of self gets moved off stage. And this is sort of might be the beginning of this recognizing that the ego itself doesn't really do anything. But to the degree that it identifies with doing things, it is, as it were, then a rightful sore of pain and bondage and misery. The components of the human psyche, it is the soul which stands nearest to the self. And the soul here is buddhi. And as we know, it's like Buddha nature, right? But the Hindus use the term buddhi slightly differently than the way the Buddhists use it. By nature, it looks towards the self. And on the other end, it stands the senses that look outward to other objects. So you could say that inward moving buddhi, which is moving towards the self, sees the self. Outward moving senses see the world in a bifurcated way and see oneself as a doer. The beginning of the process of integration then is to detach the senses from their proper objects. We identify with our senses, we have this exterior oriented, we need to move backwards. The wisdom of the man may possess as wind sweeps away a ship into water, so the senses may be curbed and subdued to the self. Buddhi is the highest faculty of man's material nature, for it is the Gita, as in Marxism, man's psychological faculties, even the highest of them are rooted in matter. Yet there is something ambivalent about Buddhi in the Gita. It seems to stand on the brink between the world of pure spirit, that is the self, that would be Atman, and man's physical and psychic nature. According to the Gita's own definition, Buddhi corresponds more or less exactly to what we in the West would call soul, since it is not only intellect but also will. The essence of the soul is will, and it is really single. But with many branches and infinite are the souls of men devoid of will. Unlike the self, the soul, exalted though it is not exempt from the onslaught of the passions. It is corrupted, and the self itself is fooled. So too the soul is not a nature unconcerned with works, but it is the subject of the play of the three constituents, material nature, which it is destroyed. Samkhya emphasizes this, as is the sattva of the soul, and sometimes dealing with it. The soul, whenever integrated or not, represents the whole personality. And here again, then, the purification of the soul is by becoming less and less identified with the, what would we call it, with the senses, and more identified with the nature of consciousness. The other aspect would be this, the Buddhi element is the sense of inner light. And one of the ways that one knows the soul is through a sense of inner light, the inward eye. And of course, here people think of the materialization of the images that one has in dreaming, but also the light that we carry on inside ourselves, an inward light that is things. But also one could say that it also carries with it the other convolutes or imaginary aspects of the senses as an inward sense. Heaven and hell, then, for the soul, really represents to the degree by which the soul identifies with sense experience. The more we identify with sense experience, the more we're in hell. The more attached we are, the more painful we are. The more we identify with the quality of consciousness itself without being caught up with any of the images that are in the world or in our experience, the less we suffer and the more we understand the natural bliss. So selflessness, force, pride, selfishness, force, pride, desire, and anger. They rely on envy and hating me who dwell in their bodies. You know, to the degree that we dwell exteriorly, we naturally caught with these poisons. We naturally suffer. And it becomes difficult. So how then does one come to liberation? The way liberation comes about is through an integration or a moving towards this inward vision of things. However, and specifically with a co-optation of the Rajas and Tamas, the two that are sort of moved inward into sattva, which is the development of bhakti. Well, this is an inward devoted bhakti, the bhakti of love for love as love. And it may begin with a, as it were, corralling of the senses through, you know, dressing an altar, you know, realizing the beauty of a statue of the god, realizing loyalty and love. But ultimately, one wants to bring it in and bring it deeper into it. And this is the bhakti, which means a variety of things. But in the Gita, it means basically devotion and loyalty to Krishna. It also means God's love for human beings. The bhaj is frequently used for sexual love and is, of course, played out an important part in the Krishna later Christian cult. The Gita has no trace of this, but the past part of the same bhakta is best translated as loyal, devote, devoted, devout, for these are its meanings. The devout here is a deep impulse of beauty towards beauty, and it's an inward beauty that is sought. It is the natural beauty of consciousness in itself more than it is it is. And this, of course, is the reality of the divine as experienced in basic awareness, but also in this case in the overwhelming vision and care of Krishna and Krishna's self. And this is one of the areas where the Bhagavad Gita brings in some new elements that were to become predominant in Indian religion for 400 or 500 years after the Gita's composition, which is the great bhakti love poets, in which the love of the divine becomes the way of galvanizing all of the senses and all of human experience into realizing this wonderful possibility. with that, I also see very closely, and though I wouldn't overemphasize it, there are several books out there that deal with Christian readings of the Bhagavad Gita. There are a number of good books that give a Christian theological reading to the Bhagavad Gita, and particularly show that there are aspects of the Krishna vision of as he expresses himself, which parallel some of the central teachings of the meaning of Jesus and the Christ. And one could say then that the Bhagavad Gita is a response to the good news of the Gospels, not directly. No recognition of Christ is made in the Bhagavad Gita, and nor are there necessarily textual variants that would that could be shown, though there are a few. But rather, the recognizing that, and that is in John's sense, the God is love. So, in the higher bhakti of Krishna, love is also this freedom. The true nature of the self is defined right at the beginning of the Gita. Never is it born nor dies, never did it come to be, nor will it come to be again. Unborn, eternal, everlasting, this is primeval. It is not slain when the body is slain. The self, then, is the natural habitat outside of time. Once liberated and once it is integrated with the whole of its material substratum, it is in the oneness of itself. It is the very self of every contingent being. It is then omnipresent beyond space. It is Brahman, and Brahman is purely pantheistic. Does this imply, then, that the self, too, is God? In a sense, yes, since it shares in this mode of being. And then again, no, since it is only a minute part of God. The Gita has two stages in the process of liberation. The first is the realization of the self as eternal, and secondly, there is the discovery of God as identical in eternal essence, but as distinct in power and personality. The first of these two accounts of liberation, God plays no significant part at all. Only later does Krishna assert his supremacy and priority, and from this point on, it is not so much liberation, which is taken for granted, that is emphasized. It is rather the relationship of selfless love that develops in eternity between God, the whole, and the self as the part. The revelation of the totality of God is the very gradual, but for everyone who is, take the trouble to read the Gita from the beginning to end, and this is the order in which it is now presumably written. The emergence of a loving God out of an impersonal Brahman is out of the experience of liberation, cannot fail to stand out. The only way to make this clear is to quote the passages in the order in which they are. Things. We're wrapping up now. Soon I will not quote these passages now, but will rather continue this introduction with the next show that we deal with on the Bhagavad Gita, and we will be doing this part. We still need to deal with the nature of the perfected human being, a little more about the nature of the divine. And then we will read the Gita itself in parts. And we will be following Stephen Mitchell's translation, which came out a few years ago. And is there are many, many good translations of the Gita. Stephen Mitchell's came out in the year 2000. And he himself is a well-known translator of poetry. And we will probably be reading through his. So we'll finish off this introduction next time on Touchstones. And also we hope to get a couple of guests in here to discuss some aspects of Hindu practice, devotion, bhakti, some other things. And we are going to also be introducing other texts of Hinduism. We are going to spend some time with some of the Upanishads. These are some of the philosophical texts, which are roughly correspond to the same time that the Buddha was learning and teaching. This is the historical Buddha. And from there, we will also look at some other classic texts and some other more modern texts of yoga. One of mine, of course, is Yoga Vashista, which are the teachings of Yoga Vashista to Rama. And Rama was the previous incarnation before Krishna. And it supposedly is a more ancient work, though actually it's a work that actually was written sometime after the Bhagavad Gita. But his teachings are distinct enough to be considered by themselves. You have been listening to Touchstones. We have been discussing some of the basic ideas in the Bhagavad Gita. We will finish this up, this introduction on another occasion, and we will go to actually considering parts of the text. And I hope you take some time. This the Bhagavad Gita is a work that all people of any religious persuasion should know and know well. It is definitely one of the great religious classics of all time, and is also a fair representation of what most modern Hindus understand and believe about their religion, at least in epitome, at least in essence. So thank you, and until next week, take care. This is WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is your community radio station, 103.5 at communityradio.coop on your FM dial.